It's election season, so that means it must be time to add services, provide for the common defense, and cut taxes. But how do you do it all? Goodbye to personal income tax is goodbye to 39% of the budget.
I love the fact that candidates are talking about big picture fundamental tax reforms, and I happen to even agree with a lot of the ideas that are being floated. We need to make sure we understand that this is going to require trade-offs. It could be politically difficult as well.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the impact of taxes. Mark Brody considers the retail meccas of the future, and we sing along with the hits while pushing our cart. But is our experience better? Plus, no more teacher tenure in California is another step in education reform. And battling wildfires for 22 years as a smoke jumper is akin to combat.
We cover each other's butts. We watch each other. We save each other's lives. Or we hold the ones that die.
And James Woods and Cesar Chavez run for office. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. At the end of 2012, Arizona had about 231 doctors for every 100,000 residents, below the national average of 260 doctors per 100,000 residents. The combination of two seismic shifts in healthcare could make that shortage even starker, implementing the Affordable Care Act and changes to how and where veterans get treated. Kim Van Pelt is Director of State Health Policy and Advocacy for St. Luke's Health Initiatives.
Well, we know that more people are likely to be insured moving forward. We know that as the population ages in general, there's going to be increased demand for health care. And we know that we have existing shortages of many health care workers, primarily or most importantly in the area of primary care. So we do know that if you're going to be having more people use the existing health care system, there may be some challenges in terms of being able to provide health care to certain populations, especially in rural areas.
Are there certain ideas perhaps other states have tried that might be helpful to Arizona perhaps going forward?
Yeah, one of the things we know that could help meet the demand for more health care workers is creating more residencies in Arizona. We know that right now we have a lot of medical school graduates who are actually going out of state to perform their residency. So the more that we can sort of create a training ground for Arizona physicians, that would certainly help that situation.
When people hear shortage of medical professionals, obviously people get nervous about that. Is there something that would have set Arizona apart? Is that something that we share almost universally with other states around the country?
Yeah, we know there are workforce shortages nationally. I think a number of things have factored into why Arizona has some particularly pronounced shortages. One is just because of our growing population and our aging population. So that's certainly contributed to the problem. We also know that some states have benefited from some policy in federal level that's allowed more resident slots to be in place in other states. So the fact that we're this fast-growing state hasn't helped us at all in terms of being able to sort of keep up with the demand for healthcare workers.
How far ahead should we be looking to see how Arizona's shortage has been modified and how much the state has been affected by the Affordable Care Act and then the changes at the VA?
We really want to look over the next 5 to 10 years about how do we grow that healthcare workforce. The changes related to the Affordable Care Act aren't going to sort of hit Arizona overnight. So I'm not looking at, you know, some immediate challenges in terms of being able to meet the health workforce needs for the state. It's really a problem that we have to sort of start planning for now over the long term.
Kurt Shepard is president and CEO of Phoenix-based community health center Valle del Sol. He says he's not as concerned about the impact of a shortage of health care providers.
I think the bigger challenge is just the complexity of navigating health care at all, be it VA or any health system. You know, as part of that creates some of the challenge for providers. You know, we have to have contracts with each individual health plan. We have to be credentialed with each individual health plan. It makes it difficult to provide access to folks unless, again, that person's on the health plan you are contracted with and your staff's credentialed. Or your provider's credential to provide health services on that plan, it's you know, becomes difficult.
Is that access situation even more complex? And I know you, with your organization, you deal with folks who get mental health care as well. Is that any more difficult than physical health care?
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe it's anymore. Again, in a lot of times, I know my wife doesn't like this, but I use her as an example. She has a chronic health condition, lupus. We have a commercial health plan, and we're not rich people, but we have means at disposal, and it's difficult for her to get the health care she needs. So I think it's just, we just have a complicated health system in America. And you add in the VA, the bureaucracy of the federal government, you know, what they have to face over there, that makes it even more difficult. But I am glad that, you know, unfortunately it takes a catastrophe like this to happen, that everyone's seeing the news, the how quickly the federal government and, you know, policymakers have moved to help free up resources for them to address this issue. So I'm sure that will help.
Kurt Shepard, president and CEO of Phoenix-based Community Health Center, Valle del Sol. We're in an election year, and that means candidates are going to promise things that may or may not actually happen. They'll also float ideas popular with their base of potential voters. In Arizona's Republican gubernatorial primary, that means talking about eliminating the state income tax. Stephen Slavinsky, senior economist with the Goldwater Institute, is a fan of the idea, but he's looking for the red meat.
As an economist, I tend to be cynical about things, and so it's not surprising I'd be cynical about politics, too. I love the fact that candidates are talking about big picture fundamental tax reforms, and I happen to even agree with a lot of the ideas that are being floated. What I would like to see more of, as you say, is just the idea that we need to make sure we understand that this is going to require trade-offs. It could be politically difficult as well, but it doesn't mean it's an endeavor worth ignoring. It's something that we should be embarking upon.
Why is this an idea worth talking about?
I think we have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, the tax system that we've got is, in a sense, a hybrid sort of Frankenstein monster. It's been cobbled together over decades. And we have to also acknowledge the fact that a lot of things that are currently untaxed in the Arizona, say, sales tax code, for instance, you know, have been untaxed for quite some time, and yet so much of the economy is shifting towards services, for instance, and also that we're competing internationally as well as nationally against states that don't have income taxes. All of these sorts of things, I think, need to be discussed, not just in a governor's candidate race, but also I think in a general policy discussion anyway, because I think it really speaks to the general sense of what we want the state tax code to look like, independent of what tax we're talking about, by the way, right? Because, I mean, I think the idea of just fixating on getting rid of the income tax, which I personally think is a laudable goal. I do think, however, we need to have a much broader discussion of figuring out what our tax system should look like once we do that. Are we going to go to what they call a more consumption-based model where we apply sales taxes to all final use goods and services, for instance, or should we do something that's more of a hybrid, although perhaps even less punitive on certain types of job creation than we currently do. But I think in the broad sense, this is a good conversation to have.
You're not a policymaker yet at this point. Maybe you never will be, maybe you don't want to be. But so I'm going to ask you a little bit to say, okay, even if this didn't go into effect, are there certain ideas that to you have more merit?
What you'd want to do is, even if you kept an income tax, you could actually create a more consumption-based flavor of an income tax by having, let's say, a flat rate across the board, low enough that it wasn't hurting people in the middle and the bottom. And instead of having the current patchwork of deductions and exemptions and tax credits, you kind of have a clean slate and instead just simply say, well, we go ahead and let people exempt whatever they save and invest. That, by definition, all that's left over is consumption. You've kind of got something that looks like, in a sense, a sales tax, except it's administered in a different way. By the same token, you can go the same direction by getting rid of the income tax and instead going to a broad-based sales tax that says any final use good and service, meaning not those that are in the process of, you know, building a bigger piece of product, let's say, you know, manufacturing inputs or something, you can exempt those, but for the most part, keep any final use good and service, like many states that don't have income taxes currently do, by the way, in their sales tax, and just say that's our new tax base, that's our consumption base. So I think heading toward a consumption base is important, and how you get there is a political matter. I think that getting rid of the income tax is a cleaner way of doing it, but there are other ways of doing it.
Considering how the states and many lawmakers have talked about their hands being tied because of how many voter-approved funds there are, the spending that has to be done, how much more daunting is it for a state like Arizona if it decides to to get rid of the income tax or do what you're talking about.
Well, there certainly are a lot of commitments that the state has, and I think that's a certain a budget problem that also needs to be talked about. But I think in terms of the practical matter, you can actually create a system that's revenue neutral, meaning it collects the same amount of revenue as the current system, and yet does some very important things to make Arizona more competitive in how the tax is administered and how the tax sits on the economy. I also think it's important to note, too, that Arizona has, as a practical matter, collects less as a share. So I think it's less than 50% of the general fund, at least from the personal income tax. Other states actually collect far more than that.
Stephen Slavinsky is senior economist for the Goldwater Institute. There's a lot that goes into creating the perfect retail environment.
Stores can struggle all they want with trying to find the right prices and trying to find the right merchandise and the right level of customer service, but they have to find the atmospherics that align with that.
Music to get you in the mood to spend. That's ahead on the show. Valley weather for tonight. We're expecting clear skies and overnight lows around 80 and sounding like a broken record. This weekend, sunny skies with high temperatures both days around 105. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. It's mostly sunny and 106 degrees at KJZZ. If you're able to get out of work a little bit early this afternoon, watch out for some accidents on the freeways. 101 southbound in the West Valley at Camelback, also the 101 westbound at 27th Avenue, and the 101 northbound in the East Valley at the Rio Salado Parkway. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. It's an original production mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, national and even international news. We hope you're enjoying it.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo, where personalized conversations can help you reach your financial goals. Because an open dialogue can open doors, Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Is it suddenly a new world for California teachers? A Los Angeles Superior Court has struck down California's teacher tenure and dismissal laws. The decision was championed by Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and our next guest, who fought for the plaintiffs in this case, former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee. She is founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Students First.
So is this a crack in the tenure armor nationally for teachers?
I think this is an absolutely huge win for public school students across the country. It really is saying that they deserve and they have a right to a high-quality education. And as part of that, a first step is ensuring that there's a highly effective teacher in every classroom in front of them every single day.
If this decision is upheld, and I suspect there's some sort of appellate review here, what freedom will management in schools have because of this decision that they don't have now?
Well, I think what the courts are saying is that the current laws and policies as they stand are not doing right by kids, are disproportionately negatively impacting poor and minority kids specifically. So what it is an opportunity to create a new paradigm, a framework for the teaching profession that ensures that we can elevate educators, but at the same time really make sure that there are protections for children. So the court is saying that these things are unconstitutional, but what the court is not doing is saying what should take its place, and that's where the hard work is really going to lie.
But theoretically, I mean, you could do like a corporate Six Sigma sort of program that every teacher would have to be measured according to very specific achievement metrics, test scores, attendance, these kinds of things, right?
Well, I think that's what we want to move to. We want to move to a system where we don't have protections in place that ensure that people have a job for life regardless of performance. You know, teachers do absolutely need some protections. There's no doubt about that. But right now it's too skewed towards a situation where grossly ineffective teachers can actually stay in the classroom. And we need more of a balance in a new system.
Respond to one of our listeners, a teacher speaking from Raleigh, North Carolina. I will be a first-year teacher next year. I'm already seeing an exodus of great teachers from North Carolina after the removal of tenure. The ones who are staying are ones lacking experience, like myself. Bad teachers with tenure can be removed. Good teachers without tenure have no job security from year to year. What's your response to that?
Well, the reality is that tenure to date in the public education system has been serving as a job protection for life regardless of performance. It's incredibly difficult to remove ineffective teachers from the classroom. And what this case showed is that grossly ineffective teachers have an incredibly negative impact on kids. In fact, there was a professor from Harvard University, Tom Kane, who testified in the case that kids lose out on about almost 12 months of academic growth if they are in an ineffective teacher's classroom versus just an average teacher's classroom. That is the kind of loss that we absolutely cannot stand for and that kids can't afford to have in their academic lives.
Let me explore that data point there for a moment. They lose a year of growth in terms of test scores, grades. I mean, how would you actually measure that year of growth?
Academic growth as measured by standardized test scores. And one of the things that we have to realize is that we are moving towards a system now where teachers are being evaluated in a much more rigorous way based on multiple measures, things like observation of their classroom, performance, their contributions to school community, but also how much their students are actually gaining academically in a given year.
Michelle, you make some great points, and I think I can see both sides of this argument, but I'm wondering if, in process terms, if the courts are a dangerous way to approach this, because it's going to create a really divisive kind of defensive situation where teachers feel under threat in state after state after state, and would this be much better handled as a legislative matter, either at the federal level or within states?
Well, a lot of states have been handling this at a legislative level, and it's just as controversial in those states. So I don't think that the court doing it is any less controversial or more controversial. I think that the reality is that whenever you shake up a system, whenever you change fundamentally a system that is more focused on the adults and job protections and privileges to one that is focused on the rights of students fundamentally, to ensure that they're getting a high-quality education, you're going to have some pushback. But I think it's important to note that in the case, there were many, many teachers who testified on behalf of the plaintiffs saying that they did not feel that it benefited the teaching profession overall to have these kinds of laws and policies in place. For example, one of the policies that the case addressed was the policy of last in, first out, which means that in the time of layoffs, it's the teachers who are the newest teachers who have to be laid off first, regardless of performance. And, the reality is that that kind of policy doesn't make any sense whatsoever. If we are in the unfortunate position where we have to lay teachers off, then we should do so by quality, by their effectiveness, by how much value they're adding to the classroom, as opposed to just based on their seniority alone.
And teachers all over the country, teachers, parents, and students all over the country will be watching the implications of this decision in California. That is absolutely certain. Michelle Rhee, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools and the founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Students First.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Soccer's World Cup is underway. Today, Mexico beat Cameroon and the Netherlands beat Spain 5-1. Today at 3, Chile will face Australia. It's Brazil's big moment on the world stage, but the tournament's price tag of $11 billion and counting has led to a wave of protests and concern among shopkeepers that people may be reluctant to spend their money on all things football, as the BBC's Katie Watson has been discovering.
I'm on 25 de Março, which is a shopping district and market in the centre of São Paulo. And it's famous among people here for being a place where you can buy everything from cheap furniture to clothes. Shopkeepers here are cashing in on the football frenzy. You can buy everything from horns, as you can hear, to football shirts. And one shop right next to me is crowded with over 40 people just trying to get a piece of the Brazilian football culture. Many people trying to buy flags or t-shirts to be able to support their team.
People always buy something to do with football, whether it's Brazil or a team from abroad, but it's always something special.
I am perhaps not as excited as I was with previous cups, but I still want to buy a shirt and to watch the games.
That's a sentiment shopkeeper João Abdullah can relate to. He runs a sports shop selling every bit of Brazilian football kit you can think of, and replica World Cup trophies too. Although it's busier than non-World Cup years, he says it's just not the same as in the past. He doubled his stock ahead of the World Cup, expecting Brazilians to go crazy for it, but he miscalculated.
Actually, my business and all the Brazilian commerce and industry has been impacted because the people from Brazil is not supporting the World Cup as much as they were supposed to, because Brazilians, soccer is our culture and people were supposed to be very happy. But there's a lot of people which are not supporting the event due to the budget the government spent on the World Cup and all the stadiums and all the transportation.
The protests in recent months have made that all too clear. Whether it's the strikes we've seen in São Paulo this week or recent protests by numerous social movements, the conversation here often comes back to the billions of dollars spent on the stadiums rather than on housing, education and health.
Is that this World Cup is not for Brazilians. This World Cup is for big corporations. FIFA and their sponsors, they control the seats, they control all the business associated to the World Cup.
Rafael Alcaldepani is from the Getúlio Vargas Foundation think tank in São Paulo.
When we had the World Cup in 1950 in Brazil, that was a World Cup when the regular Brazilian would queue on the front of the stadium to buy the tickets to watch the Brazilian team.
Brazil's hosting of the World Cup and the Olympics in 2 years' time was seen as a perfect opportunity to boost the economy and upgrade infrastructure in cities across Brazil. While the optimists say much more has been achieved than if there had been no football tournament, preparations have been marred by missed deadlines and social unrest. Brazil's known as the home of samba and football, an image that many Brazilians want to shake. They want to be taken seriously, but the country still struggles to break out of its mould. Simon Anholt is an expert on how countries brand themselves.
In a way, Brazil has got an image which is no longer all that useful for it. Because it's regarded as being basically decorative rather than useful, this has been absolutely fine for stimulating tourism over the decades. But Brazil is trying to do something very different now. Brazil is trying to position itself as one of the pillars of the global polity. It's a BRIC nation. It's trying to be a major regional power. And to be regarded as merely decorative, if that's what you're trying to be, is actually problematic. Because it means that people will love you and adore you, but not respect you or take you very seriously.
But João very much wants people to take the World Cup seriously. He hopes that once a Brazilian team starts winning, people will become more enthusiastic, and that can translate into more sales.
That's the BBC's Katie Watson. A quick note about this next story. It does contain a graphic description of a burn victim. It's fire season. When a wildfire starts, some of the first to put their lives on the line are smoke jumpers. These daredevils fall from the sky to work in some of the most rugged and remote spots in the country. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz Uribe talked with a retired smoke jumper who survived 22 years on the fire lines.
Meet Jeff Davis. Walking into his small apartment in Silver City, New Mexico, is like walking into a jungle. It's consumed by 5-foot-tall ferns.
I got a sign up there that says, I need the high country. I'm not any good down in these neon plastic valleys.
By high country, Davis means the wilderness. Just north is the Gila National Forest, which includes the nation's first designated wilderness. Davis spent 9 fire seasons there, chasing smoke.
So I'm trying to bring the wilderness down here.
At age 77, with a fragile back, his backcountry days are done. Still, he manages to run 8 miles every day. Staying in shape is programmed into his psyche. It was a key part of his life as a smoke jumper, arguably the most thrilling job in the U.S. Forest Service.
We're a firefighter. The only difference with us is our means of access to the fire. We jump in. We go in by parachute. And the purpose is we can get there fast, faster than anybody.
The idea is to put the fire out before it has a chance to grow.
We used to jump from 1,000 feet AGL, above ground level. From 1,000 feet, you've got 11 seconds from the door to the ground if your chute doesn't open. Time kind of slows down. You're right in the moment, and you're acting just by instinct.
Smoke jumpers often drop into unfamiliar territory. Once on the ground, they're pretty much on their own. They've got a chunk of map and 120 pounds of gear on their back.
So we grab our tools, and we go to the fire.
They put the fire out not with water, but with muscle. Using shovels and Pulaskis, they dig a line around the flames. The line resembles a forest trail.
Temperature might be 100, 110 even, and we're just sweating like pigs. Radiant heat was just burning us good.
The smoke jumpers might stick around for a few days, watching for hot spots. They camp out and contend with the elements, whether it's a rainstorm or a grizzly bear. But that never bothered Davis.
It wasn't a job and it wasn't a career, it was a love affair.
He describes the easy fires like paid vacations with spectacular scenery. Then there were the ugly fires, wild, uncontrollable blazes that cost firefighters their lives. Davis witnessed these in California, where the greasewood acts like matches doused in diesel.
You'd watch a whole hillside just suddenly painted with fire. It went up that hill so fast you couldn't even imagine it. And the sound you can't hear and the fury of it.
Some develop into firestorms with temperatures that can reach 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. They'll even create their own weather. Davis remembers rescuing a crew from the destructive Coyote Fire near Santa Barbara in 1964. He saw a man staggering up a cliff with his arms stretched out.
So I went running over to him and I grabbed his arm to pull him out of that burn. And all his skin on his whole arm slid off like a barbecued chicken.
Today, Davis's apartment is a shrine to his profession. Old photographs cover the walls. He makes model smoke jumpers with clay and Barbie dolls. It's obvious he misses it.
An old jumper buddy of mine, a couple of years ago, he called me and said, I think we can get you out on one of these skydiving clubs. We can get you a jump.
The only catch was Davis had to do it strapped to another skydiver for health reasons.
I said, hell no, I'm not cargo. I'm a jumper. I'm either jumping or forget that. And I could, if I got a chance today, I'd do her. My fake hip would fall out and stick out in the air, and my pacemaker would take some extra thumps and a few other.
Nowadays, Davis gets by on a modest disability check. The younger jumpers know that. At the end of fire season, they'll leave a care package at his door.
We're brothers. Whether they're men or women, we're bros. We cover each other's butts. We watch each other. We save each other's lives. Or we hold the ones that die, and we get them out of there. We don't leave anybody behind.
Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, reporting from Silver City, New Mexico.
Good afternoon. This is 91.5 KJZZ. In the news, forest officials say a risky flood zone has been created in the aftermath of the slide fire that burned around northern Arizona's Oak Creek Canyon. Experts said today that runoff and erosion from the slide fire could occur at a higher rate than normal during any future storm. To the Valley freeways, accidents on the 101 westbound at 7th Avenue, also the 101 westbound at 27th Avenue, and in the East Valley, a collision on the 101 northbound at Rio Salado Parkway. This is the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news.
KJZZ is supported by SRP Community Solar, offering customers a new way to adopt solar energy. More information online at srpcommunitysolar.com.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Rebecca Myskowski, and I'm watching my nephew Zachary at Jump Street.
Attention jumpers, the time is now 6 o'clock.
He gets to run around and get all that energy out, and he really has a blast. When he's in the foam pit, he likes showing me how he can spin and jump into the foam balls. He likes showing me the things that he can do on trampolines, and I enjoy watching him. Not in this particular trampoline area, but I have jumped on trampolines before, and it's fun.
Rebecca Myskowski with her nephew Zachary at Jump Street, an indoor trampoline park in Glendale. If you hear something we should hear, aim high and send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jamie McIntyre. President Obama says he's considering a range of military and diplomatic options to help Iraq repel Islamist insurgents who are threatening Baghdad, but he has flatly ruled out one option, sending U.S. combat troops back in. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Secretary of State John Kerry says the risk posed by militants in Iraq could eventually pose a threat to U.S. interests, too.
President Obama says he's considering all options to support the Iraqi government, and Kerry tells reporters on a trip to London that he expects the president will move quickly. He says the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which has captured major Iraqi cities this week, is a threat to the entire region.
We've already taken some immediate steps, including providing enhanced aerial surveillance support to assist the Iraqis in this fight. We've also ramped up shipments of military aid to Iraq.
Kerry says Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki also needs to do more to put aside sectarian differences, which analysts say are fueling the conflict. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The gross domestic product of North Dakota is growing faster than that of any state in the country and by a considerable margin. Dan Boyce with member station KUNC reports the oil and gas boom is fueling the state's rapid economic growth.
North Dakota's GDP growth in 2013 was almost 10%. Compare that with the nation as a whole, less than 2%. The state lies at the heart of an underground oil formation called the Bakken. New fracking technologies in the last decade have made it possible to drill for a lot of that oil and natural gas for the first time. Oil and gas directly counts for about a third of North Dakota's economic growth, but the state is growing across almost every sector. North Dakota also has the lowest unemployment rate in the nation. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Denver.
Dow up 41. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon, it's the show, and I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
With many, many apologies to Shakespeare, we ask, what's in a political name? Arizona's had its share of familiar-sounding politicos, from Dean Martin to Paul Newman to Jerry Lewis, and this fall there's a congressional candidate named Cesar Chavez. The candidate changed his name from Scott Fissler. He had run unsuccessfully for office under that name. Catherine Alonzo, founding partner of the campaign consulting firm Javelina, says political branding isn't all that uncommon from efforts in the business world, and she says that includes a candidate's name.
Any candidate has a slew of things at the beginning that makes up who they are as a person, what your background is, your name, and lots of things that you have to sort of piece together as part of the story. Some candidates have a name that's really going to be an asset to them, and you leverage it in a different way than if you have a name that's harder to remember, harder to pronounce. People can't tell as much from you from your name. And if you have a really well-known name, a name that's been, you know, really associated with progressive American history, then obviously that is an asset. But it's one of the tools in the toolbox.
I mean, do voters really pay attention to, you know, I think of politicians in Arizona, people like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis and Paul Newman, who are, you know, those are their names, but they're obviously those names are known for other people. Does that in any way play on voters' minds when they're deciding for whom they're going to vote?
I think it can. You know, I think in a crowded ballot, your eyes may be drawn to a name that is familiar to you for other reasons. You know, when you're branding, you're trying to get your name to stick in people's heads. So if that name sticks in people's heads anyway for other reasons, then that is an asset and a benefit. I don't believe that voters, when they supported Paul Newman, believed they were voting for Paul Newman, the actor. You know, so I think other than really drawing that name out of the crowd on a crowded ballot, I don't think that it moves a large number of people. And then I think where it has the greater impact is the races that are less well-known and voters have less information about.
I mean, do you think there are any voters who live in Congressional District 7 who might think they're voting for the Cesar Chavez?
I don't. I think that there will be voters that notice the name that they may not have noticed if the individual that's running as Cesar Chavez, formerly known as Scott Fistler, if he was listed on the ballot as Scott Fistler, then I think that he would potentially get less attention. But I don't think, because of all the other things you need to run as a successful candidate, I think that that isn't going to translate into a large vote share for him.
Do candidates handle it differently if their name is familiar for a reason other than politics versus a reason that is for politics? For example, someone like Laura Pastor or Justin Johnson, who are the children of well-known Arizona politicians who happen to run against each other for Phoenix City Council. Does it matter for what the name is known?
I don't think so. I think that that recognition is what's important. Now, I think where it does matter is when your name is known within politics and more is attached to that name. You know, and to use the Paul Newman example again, the associations with the actor Paul Newman doesn't translate into any kind of assumptions about ability to do the job well. Whereas I think if you're running on a family name that has been in politics, there's an association with that other person's achievements, platforms, what they've brought to the community. So I think that a well-known name within politics translates into greater support. But that, even then, it's not the name that does it. It's the base support that already exists at the beginning of your race.
Catherine Alonzo is founding partner of the Phoenix-based campaign consulting firm Javelina.
There's another congressional candidate Mark and Catherine didn't mention, who also finds himself among famous namesakes who've tried to win political office in Arizona. Democrat James Woods is making his first run for the U.S. House in the 5th District, currently represented by Matt Salmon. Woods is blind. He lost his sight at the age of 26 because of complications related to an antibiotic-resistant infection and his type 1 diabetes. Improving accessibility for disabled voters is an important part of Woods' campaign, as he recalls the first time he voted in 2008 after going blind.
Well, first of all, I wasn't able to read Braille. So I was able to sign up for the permanent early voter list that Arizona offers, which is a great program that should be expanded. And my caregiver, who is my father, helped me fill out the ballot. And I've been using the permanent early voter list ever since. If I didn't have that option, getting to even a polling place would be difficult. I would need somebody to go into the polling place with me. Now they do have the talking machines, which is great, but if I didn't have a caregiver that could take me to a polling place, that would be incredibly difficult. Candidate websites, especially back then, were inaccessible to me, and I would have to have any kind of literature that I got read to me, and that was really inconvenient, and it took a lot of time.
Can you give us an idea about how available Braille ballots are? How does that work? Is that something that has gotten better? And do you read Braille now?
I do read Braille now. There is two levels of Braille. There's Braille level 1 and Braille level 2. I'm still learning to level 2. Level 2 allows it to be more condensed. I'm not great at that, so I still use the permanent early voter list with help. It's gotten a lot better for blind accessibility, but there's still just general accessibility. I'm also a partial amputee.
Okay.
So my mobility is not great. And I can't stand in long lines for very long. Lots more people have that problem, just getting to the polls.
Are there suggestions you would make to make people are more aware of it and then progress is made on that front?
Making websites more accessible. Having just a little link at the top, usually, that says click here for plain HTML for screen reader users. And it just strips off all like the animations and formatting that can sometimes cause problems with screen readers. Makes a huge difference for people with visual impairments. Another thing is campaign videos on YouTube and such.
Mm-hmm.
Having a transcript for someone with a hearing disability or subtitles would be a big deal. And those kind of things don't cost anything. They just take a little bit of time, a little bit of forethought.
James, do you think the political system itself, we've talked about voting accessibility, do you think it's harder to access for potential candidates who might have disabilities?
Yes, we've had some interesting issues with that with our campaign because I am blind. getting places. We went to a forum, a biotech forum, that was put on by the Flynn Foundation. It was a great presentation, but all of the materials were completely inaccessible to me. Like, they had a packet of bios and, you know, their roadmap and all those things, which were completely unavailable to me. Also, just research, like Pew Research charts and data from the federal government, charts and graphs from like demographic research or the General Accounting Office, most of those aren't accessible. The actual text of them are usually, because it's usually in a PDF format, the actual text is fine, but sometimes the information is only in chart form, and those are inaccessible.
Fifth District Congressional candidate James Woods talking about improving accessibility for disabled voters. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody. A Utah judge said today that people living in Warren Jeff's polygamous sect on the Utah-Arizona border, who've collectively failed to pay millions in occupancy fees for their houses, should be evicted. World Cup news. The World Cup is underway, and today Mexico beat Cameroon 1-0. The Netherlands, meanwhile, beat Spain 5-1. And coming up in just about 15 minutes, Chile will face Australia. In Valley traffic, a new accident on the 51 northbound. It's at 32nd Street, and it's blocking the shoulder. There's also an accident on the 101 northbound in the East Valley at the Rio Salado Parkway. Valley weather for tonight. Clear skies, overnight lows around 80. And then for this weekend, sunny skies, no surprise, with high temperatures between 104 and 107. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. We're mostly sunny and 106 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by High Health. Proud to introduce OcuCell, a daily multivitamin with advanced eye support. OcuCell, nourish your body, love your vision. Exclusively at all High Health Valley locations or highhealth.com.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody.
It may be hard to believe this time of year, but shopping centers are starting to open themselves up to the elements. And this new wave of outdoor malls doesn't just include stores and restaurants, but also office space and housing. Jeff Green is president of retail consulting firm Jeff Green Partners. He met me at one of the new kinds of malls, Scottsdale Quarter, which is across the street from a similar center, Kierlin Commons.
Mixed-use developments where there is office, there's hotel, there's multifamily housing and retail are really the places retailers want to go into now.
Why is that?
Because those are built-in demand components for the retailers right on the project. Plus, they tend to actually be smaller and a little bit more intimate retail projects.
What are some of the potential pitfalls of a center like this?
Well, layout is a big issue in a center like this because in this center, Scottsdale Quarter, for example, we have a couple wings that are a little quieter than some of the others, which makes it harder to lease and harder for consumers to cross shop. Also, parking is also an issue.
Would you imagine that eventually there just won't be indoor shopping malls like we're used to seeing anymore? Or is there still a place for those?
Oh, there's still a place for indoor shopping malls, actually. It's just that we won't see many new ones. In fact, there's only one enclosed regional mall that's going to open this year, and that's in Sarasota, Florida.
In a center like this and across the street at Kierlin, there are a number of restaurants that are not necessarily chain restaurants. There are some chain restaurants, but there are also some that locals might know from restaurateurs or chefs locally here.
Well, it's interesting because chef-driven concepts, which is really kind of the newest craze in the restaurant industry, is usually about local chefs and independent chefs. And they love locations like this because they love the urban feel. They want to be part of a destination that's daytime and nighttime like this is.
How does a place like this do during the summer?
Well, I think with Scottsdale Quarter, there are two issues. One, it's a very seasonal population too, which means that the summers are much quieter. That combined with the fact that it's outdoors and people don't necessarily like to shop outdoors when it's this hot. But the good thing is when it cools down at night, there's a lot of outdoor experience as it relates to going into the movie theater and all the restaurants that surround it.
So does a place like Scottsdale Quarter, Kierlin, Biltmore Fashion Park, do they have to sort of generate some of that attention in the evenings after the sun goes down, especially during the summer?
Well, it's interesting. All three of those centers that you just mentioned have a strong restaurant component, and that's where usually the nighttime traffic comes from.
In Scottsdale Quarter, as we were walking to where we're sitting now, there was sort of a mix of stores that you've heard of, national chains, and some that are unique maybe to this location, or just have a couple of stores or not big national chains. What is the ideal mix of places like that for a center like this to succeed?
Well, I think you would want maybe 10 to 15% independent and the rest to be chain oriented. That's basically for the developer to have credit-worthy tenants as opposed to independent tenants that they may have to subsidize. However, in the center like this, we're looking at, you know, somewhere between 25 and 30% of these stores being independent stores. But that's good for a center like this because it actually expands their trade area.
Do you see more centers like this opening up in the Phoenix area in the next year, 2 years, 5 years?
No, I mean, I know that there's the Estrella development that Macer's just trying to do. Other than that, I don't really see many of these developments occurring in the future because, you know, at the moment, Phoenix is well stored, if you will.
Do the developers of these outdoor centers tend to look specifically at the part of town they're locating in to determine what types of places they're going to put in here?
Well, the beauty of these centers is they're not formulaic. They're built to the market. They're built to the demographic of the market. They're built to the shopper, and they're built to the voids of the market.
Jeff Green is president of retail consulting firm Jeff Green Partners.
Have you ever danced with your grocery cart or tried an electric slide while squeezing the produce? Then you know the effect supermarket music has on your shopping experience. Secret agent man.
Secret agent man. Stores can struggle all they want with trying to find the right prices, the right merchandise, and the right level of customer service, but they have to find the atmospherics that align with that.
Joe Dobrow is a former marketing executive for Whole Foods and Sprouts. He says the right music keeps customers shopping longer and spending more.
There are chains, for example, like the Fresh Market, which is about a 150-store chain, mostly in the southeast, midwest, a little bit in the west, and they play classical music. So you walk in and it's Vivaldi, and you can guess that there's not a lot of soccer moms in that store, and you can guess within 3 seconds of walking in the store what the pricing scheme is, what the quality of the food is, etc. The music literally sets the tone. Sprouts used to play all 50s and 60s. And when you think about it, this is a chain that's trying to promote natural foods, good foods, and let's face it, the food in the 50s and 60s was really bad, and it was really unnatural. So it was a very strange choice of music in a lot of ways. But you'd have customers coming in there, and they'd kind of be rocking out to Dion playing Run Around Sue. And there were those who liked it, and there were a lot who didn't. And I think a lot of the ones who didn't just ended up not shopping there.
And conscientious markets work hard to figure out what music is in tune with current and future shoppers. John Bradley is chief music officer with Custom Channels, which creates in-store playlists for retailers, among others. He says some clients are focused on the role music plays, others not so much.
We divide our customers and potential customers into two camps. Those that are very music conscious take music as part of their business very seriously, and those that don't give it a second thought just use it to fill the space. So those that take it seriously look at it as part of the atmosphere, part of the environment, just like the lighting, the paint, the furniture that's in the store. If we're asked to come with an agenda, they may not have any idea. They'll describe their place of business. We'll ask them a lot of questions about the business space and their clientele and what their their brand is like. And then we'll come up with some audio mixes, some music mixes, and we'll ask them, hey, does this sound like what you're thinking?
Bradley says the internet streaming makes it possible to change the music if the client feels like shoppers aren't getting in the right groove that they were hoping for.
And their expectations are that the music will consciously or subconsciously make that customer feel better about the experience that the person is getting while they're in that store or that restaurant. And when I say subconsciously, sometimes you don't even know what you're listening to, but you know it makes you feel really good. Or consciously, you know that, like, what is that song playing? That shouldn't be on because it's so obviously misplaced. Or very consciously that, wow, what a great song. I love that song. And you start moving and you maybe start singing along. We work with a lot of retailers that play the music loud enough in their store that they notice it when they see customers dancing while they're shopping.
But if you think the music is just for the people walking around the stores for a few minutes, Bradley says not so fast.
We program as much for the employees as for the shoppers, because it's the employees that have to work there far longer than the shoppers have to shop there. And they don't want to be hearing the same songs in the same order day after day after day. So we mix it up a lot.
In 2012, American shoppers spent more than $420 billion on food at grocery stores. Anything that leads to increasing that by just a little bit, including a song that makes you feel good, is going to be tried. Again, former marketing executive Joe Dobrow.
When you're talking about a business that usually has these razor-thin margins, you know, overall corporate margins of 2, 3, 5% if you're doing extremely well, just getting that little bit of incremental business because a customer really digs your music, that's worth it.
City street names often tell a story about the history of a place. Names are often related to its founders, famous natives, and even interesting things that make the area unique. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us the story of downtown Phoenix.
In the late 1800s, the original Phoenix area consisted of 320 acres of land. Today, that area is from Van Buren Street to Harrison Street, and from 7th Street to 7th Avenue. Did you know the north-south streets were not always numbered?
The city is platted in 1870, and it grows kind of slowly over the next two decades. 1,700 people by 1880 and a little over 3,000 by 1890.
Philip Vandermeer is an ASU history professor. As we stand on the corner of 2nd and Adams Streets, he explains how this downtown area looked back then.
There was a mixture of Anglo immigrants, European immigrants, and immigrants from Mexico. And it was about 50% Hispanic up to 1880. But after that time, the promoters thought that they really wanted to tout this as an American city. And so they really looked to encourage more Anglo immigration.
And to do that, Vandermeer says, the townspeople thought they needed to modernize the area. New structures were built influenced by neoclassic and Victorian architectural styles. The locals, he said, also decided to modernize the street names. Like many cities across the country, Phoenix named some of its streets after early presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson. Those streets run east-west. Up until the 1890s, the small town's north-south streets were named after Native American tribes. Starting from 7th Avenue and going east to 7th Street, the names were
Yavapai, Hulapai, Kokopai, Yuma, Papago, Mojave, Cortez, Montezuma, Maricopa, Pima, Pinal, Arapahoe, and Tonto and Apache.
Vandermeer says Central Avenue didn't change much. It was originally Center. He says there were a lot of debates over the name changes at the time. Many said changing them was a way of removing the past and not honoring the pioneers.
The proponents said that this was modern and it would make delivery of mail easier. Putting numbers seemed, in a simple stroke, to be creating a more modern image for the city.
Since then, Phoenix north-south streets have been numbered. As a matter of fact, they continue west, with street numbers going as far as 595th Avenue. Going east, the numbering system stops at around 230th Street. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas for a Did You Know, we won't say no, probably. You can send them to our email address, theshow@kjzz.org. Next Friday, we'll bring in our resident quizmaster, Leszek Pawlowicz, for a new segment called The Quiz Show. Leszek is a Jeopardy ace who's won a tournament of champions. He'll face off against one of us in a game of trivia, but you can get on in the action too. Just solve this word puzzle. Take a one-syllable word and add one letter to it to make a three-syllable word that's also the name of a desert plant. And here's a hint, the plant also makes a popular type of liquor. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw one name from the correct answers, and Leszek will play on your behalf. If he wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. It's Father's Day weekend, so a lot to do with Dad, including, you'll really want to take part in this, the Cheesy Tie Weekend. It's Friday and Saturday from 7th at 7:30 p.m., also 9:45 p.m. at the National Comedy Theater in Mesa. If you wear an ugly tie, you'll receive a $2 discount on a show. Also on Saturday, Bloomin' Beer Fest at the Irish Cultural Center in Phoenix from 7 until 11 p.m. You can enjoy pints for an early celebration of the 110th anniversary of when Leopold Bloom made the journey immortalized in James Joyce's Ulysses. Also, the Valley of the Sun Juneteenth celebration is taking place tomorrow night from 5 until 9 at the Eastlake Community Center in Phoenix. Monsoon Madness, that's actually tonight from 5 until 6 at Cave Creek Regional Park. A discussion of what monsoons are, what causes them, and how to safely prepare for their arrival. And I saved the best for last. Saturday night at 8 at Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino, the comedian Sinbad. The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Managing editors Al Macias, news director Peter O'Dowd. Executive producer is John Hoven. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's 3 o'clock at KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.